Welcome to NetSmart Care Threads, a podcast where human services and post-acute leaders across the healthcare continuum come together to discuss industry trends, challenges, and opportunities. Listen as we uncover real stories about how to innovate and improve the quality of care for the communities we serve. Let's get into the show.
My name is Mike Dordick. I'm president of McBee and SVP of Post-Acute Strategy for NetSmart. Really happy to have Dr. Steve Landers join us. I've known Steve and worked with Steve for lots of years, and a great addition to the new National Alliance for Care at Home. For those of you who don't know, the National Alliance for Care at Home was a merger of the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization and National Home Care and Hospice Organization. So Steve has a wealth of knowledge. He's a physician, a geriatric physician, and has worked in both the provider setting and now advocating for all of us in DC and what's happening. So with that, I want to turn it over to Steve.
Thanks, Mike. To get a chance to speak with you just means so much to me. You're a friend. I consider you a mentor. I remember back many years ago and some of the help and work you gave and work we did together at VNA Health Group that really made such an impact, and just have always been proud to know you. I'm joined by my colleague, Patrick Harrison, who is one of the great alliance regulatory and compliance leaders, and to help out depending on the topics that we decide to touch on. We're, unlike our prior organizations, we're going away from acronyms, folks. So no complex letters. If you want to shorten us, our name is the Alliance, but otherwise we're the National Alliance for Care at Home. And because of the vision of our board and members, we have brought together over 1,500 provider organizations, 10,000 locations of those organizations, representing every state, every territory, and over 100 state association members that are involved in care at home. Home care and hospice, home health. It is a broad coalition. We are representing care at home advocates in all types of circumstances: rural, urban, large providers, small providers, health system affiliated organizations, independent, nonprofit organizations, faith-based, investor-owned, franchisors. This is a strong, deep, diverse coalition in the care at home space. It means everything to me and the team to have your vote of confidence and to have your support in the incredible work that we have to do ahead, because there's so much to do to make sure we have a vibrant care at home sector in our country. I can't be more proud, though, than to be a part of it. The whole Alliance team really feels proud in a small way to be a part of your organizations and to be a part of your team. And that's what we're here for. We're here for advocacy, education, professional networking. We want to help build a brighter future. Again, our goal is to see a future where everyone can access high quality care at home. That's the vision of the Alliance. And a lot of that comes down to the decisions that our policymakers, pick up on. We are interested in the growth and evolution of care at home. So why does it matter? I think if we are going to get the credibility and the attention that we need and deserve because of the value that we're providing for families and for the system, we have to remind decision makers of the major strategic issues our country is facing. And one of the most important issues that is before us is aging. And this is a different kind of aging than the discussion 5 years ago, 10 years ago, about all the baby boomers hitting 65, okay? Our baby boomers are starting to hit 80. We are seeing a boom in the population age 85 plus. In 2020, we had approximately 6 million people in the country age 85 plus. By 2060, that number is expected to have tripled to 19 million people. And the issues that people 85 plus face, the strategies, the things that are important, change a bit when we think about 85 and older, when we think about the older old folks, there's been a lot of wonderful progress in medical care, healthy lifestyles. We have the most vibrant older population probably in the history of the country and the history of the world right now, and it hopefully will continue and get stronger. But that said, there are still quite high rates of disability and quite high rates of chronic illness in that population. And of course, if you look at any home health, hospice, home care organization in the country, I think you'll see, except for the pediatric providers, which by the way are incredibly important in doing incredible life-changing work, but you will see that the typical age of the population being cared for is in that mid to late 80s. Of course, there are younger folks that have had bad luck or are going through a difficult treatment, but it's that population. When we look at that group, right now, only a third of our country's 85 plus population reports being free of disability or free of any difficulty with activities of daily living. So there's a lot of needs there. At the same time as that 85 plus population is booming, the population in ages that have typically served as caregivers is stagnant. So the ratios, the care, what we call caregiver support ratios, are going down. And so when we think about how are we going to have independence, dignity, how are we going to have cost-effective healthcare programs as a country, Medicare, Medicaid, other support programming, housing, what have you? How are families going to afford their circumstances? And I think the key thing to understand, from my perspective, with an aging population that our policymakers must understand, is that care at home is one of the few win-win opportunities, right? A lot of these budget-related maneuverings and how are we going to, you know, navigate the debt and deficits just involve cutting things and involve squeezing things. And it's kind of, you know, we save, but people lose out. Care at home is an opportunity to do things in the health and long-term care system at a lower cost, but desirable. That's a win-win. Patient preferred, better deal for taxpayers in the system. What we get to focus on, and I know this is foundational and basic for many of you, and it's part of your daily lives, but I want to help, I want your help shaping the messages that we give policymakers and make sure that it's working, and also want your help in amplifying the story. And, you know, patients and families embrace, and this isn't just anecdotal, we have research and studies in the area of preference. People get to get care somewhere that's familiar. There's dignity and comfort. You remain in your community as best you can. And also there's risks associated with institutional settings, you know, pressure injuries, nosocomial infections, delirium, because, you know, people that have fragile cognition are in an unfamiliar environment. Many risks. I'd also say that you know, from a clinical standpoint, there's some advantages to taking care of people in the home setting, right? We get to see them. We get to understand them more as a person. You get to see all those environmental issues that might be playing a role in their health and their well-being, medication management, nutrition, caregiving issues. You can assess that a lot better when you see people in the home rather than in an office. And you can bond with people. This is it's a true act of caring and humility that we go out and see people, you know, where they live on their own turf. So important to families, important to the public, important to patients, but also many different studies, analyses have shown that when deployed and targeted the right ways, care at home models, home health, home care, hospice care, and palliative care at home can substitute for and prevent higher cost facility-based care. In a lot of ways, it leverages family caregiving and personal resources in a way so that the dose of systemic cost is titrated to family needs rather than having to provide all-encompassing residential or institutional care. And sometimes by getting out to see people early in the home setting, we can prevent, you know, their decline in ways that keep them in the home. So it's an incredibly important model that is at the core of any rational strategy for how to compassionately and cost-effectively meet the needs of an aging population. I think the real thing to have on all of our minds, that more and more home in people's home, wherever they call home, is the center of care. That's the primary venue of healthcare, certainly with technology and video conferencing and monitoring more and more, whether that care at home is through the front door or through some type of device, the home is healthcare, the primary healthcare setting for our future and for our country's future. I think one of the most striking examples of care at home is the acute care at home program, hospital at home. Hospital home is a wonderful model. And I highlighted, though, not just to talk about hospital at home, but to point out it's been a well-studied care at home model. And I think some of the insights carry over to other types of care at home. So we saw in hospital at home, when elders with certain chronic illness exacerbations and infections were moved from the emergency room to a home-based care model, when you compared them to the people that went upstairs in the hospital that were similarly situated, they had lower mortality rates, lower complications like infections and delirium, and the overall spending was lower, and there was a positive experience. These outcomes were well documented in the hospital at home research, and that's been part of what stimulated the CMS Innovation Center programming around acute care at home. But these concepts resonate beyond acute care at home. Of course, some of those infection risks, delirium risks, the opportunity to be in a lower cost setting, these all are thematic benefits to care at home. So we talked about preference, and main thing I wanted to share here is make sure you all have the best references and information about the preference for care at home. And so through survey work and through a number of different studies, there was actually, it's cited at the end here, at last year, 2024, a group of Harvard Public School of Public Health researchers, including world-famous health economist David Grabowski, did a study about preferences for post-acute care and for where people want post-acute care that was published in JAMA Health Forum. And the preference was strong for care at home as an alternative to facility-based post-acute care. They did something called a ranked choice experiment. I'm not going to get into it, but you all should be aware of it. One of the things that happens in my work, and you probably experience this, is a lot of stuff. We need more research. We need to study care at home better to show the value. No question, we need more research and we need that. But we also need to talk about, know, share, and disseminate the research that we have. And this was an incredibly important study done just last year, showing, demonstrating the preference for care at home amongst older adults and their caregivers. And we've got to talk about it. You know, on that value proposition, one of the things that was just so wonderful out of the sadness of losing President Carter was the celebration of hospice care and his 19-month stay in hospice and the ability to get truly excellent end of life care in the place that he's most comfortable. That was a really important thing to highlight for hospice care, because of course, much of hospice care, not all of it, but much of hospice care is a home-based end of life care model. And we have to always, especially as some of the nuances and some of the limitations of our payment systems are highlighted, weaknesses are brought forward in the media or in policy circles, got to make sure that our entire country, and especially our policymakers, understand that hospice is a national treasure. And we're going to talk, it's a high-value program in many, many, many care scenarios. Hospice is saving the system, while saving the system money, while having extraordinary high rates of family satisfaction, while delivering incredibly compassionate team-based services. The core mission of Medicare, by the way, if you read, you know, President Johnson's remarks when signing Medicare into law, was that it was a law about addressing untended suffering in a country bursting with abundance. Hospice is at the core of how we as a country address untended suffering. But also, as an additional benefit, when deployed in many circumstances, hospice saves the system money. The NORC University of Chicago study a couple years back looked at the impact of hospice on the Medicare system, demonstrated particularly for people that had 11-day stay up through a year, had lower overall Medicare costs. So if anything, those very short stay situations are still, they're not optimizing care or compassion, and they're also not really creating the same benefit in terms of overall cost of care that a longer stay might provide. And so we've got to make sure that our decision makers understand this. Hospice is, it needs to grow. It's the median length of stay has been stagnant, around 17 days. The percent of Medicare beneficiaries entering hospice has been relatively stagnant, just over 50%. And there's so much opportunity to make a difference for people and families, and also make the system more cost-effective by getting people into hospice earlier and more people in hospice care. So I think that an overarching message that I'm providing, and I'm hoping our alliance will do a great job sharing with our policymakers, is that we have this incredible opportunity. Care at home, home health, home care, Medicaid, home and community services, hospice and palliative care at home, new and emerging care at home models such as acute care at home and home-based primary care and other care management models at home, offer an incredible opportunity, really in many ways, one of the few win-win solutions for an aging population. In spite of that, we're not at capitalizing opportunity. We are missing the mark as a country with respect to the care at home opportunity. When we look at home health, we are seeing as home health payment reform implementation started in 2020, as we've had to deal with all the labor cost inflation and workforce issues associated with the pandemic and the economic issues therein, as we've seen an increasing penetration of Medicare Advantage as a larger Medicare payer, we have seen home health stagnate. We have fewer traditional Medicare beneficiaries receiving home health. The payments within the traditional Medicare home health system have gone down significantly. We started 2019 with $17.8 billion in Medicare home health spending. And last year, that number was probably just over $15 billion. And of course, in real dollars, because of inflation, that's a lot bigger of a drop than it even sounds. And so I would argue, flawed and misguided implementation of home health payment reform, or the launch of the new home health payment model, the patient-driven groupings model, or PDGM, has contributed to a stagnation and even a backing off of the strategic home health resources that our country has to solve these problems. And that means that means less comfort, less dignity, harder issues for families and caregivers. And it probably means we're spending more on unnecessary hospitalization and nursing home stays. So if we go back to 2019, before home health payment reform was implemented, we're talking about Medicare beneficiaries receiving traditional Medicare beneficiaries receiving over 100 million home visits per year. That number is down to around 60 million. Of course, the change of the therapy rules and how that played into care delivery and the necessity of more close case management have happened, and there may have been some potentially wasteful visits in the past, but the enormity of decline in what beneficiaries are receiving is significant, and it's the wrong direction for an aging nation that needs a vibrant care at home program for its elders. I'll just point out another area that is near and dear to my heart. It's how I got involved in care at home is as a physician provider making home visits and house calls to homebound elders, providing medical care in their home. When we track the trends in these type of services, these are physician and other practitioner, maybe advanced practice nursing, podiatry services in the Medicare program. These services basically are stable. We're not seeing them dramatically increase. And also, they've not really fallen off when you adjust for the overall Medicare population. And of course, when we look at the Medicaid system and states, and this topic may become even more intense as states have to navigate maybe some changes to Medicaid that are being discussed in reconciliation in Congress, is, you know, the rebalancing, if you will, the moving Medicaid long-term care resources in the home and community setting, that has been a value creator for state Medicaid programs. Of course, Medicaid also provides for extensive long-term care services for people with younger people with disabilities and developmental and other types of neurological concerns earlier in life. But that's kind of stagnant. And again, another opportunity for our policymakers is to look at the state level, how do they continue that elder care at home opportunity, create value for the system, and support people where they want to be. The future, in my view, I love the Eleanor Roosevelt quote. I think about, you know, Eleanor Roosevelt's view that the future belongs to those that believe in the beauty of their dreams. I think about my former boss, Toby Cosgrove at Cleveland Clinic, who would say that the future belongs to those that seize the opportunities created by innovation, seize the opportunities created by innovation. So believe in the beauty of our dreams and seize the opportunities created by innovation. And for our country, I think it's both a better dream and it's an innovation opportunity to push more of our care, our health care, our end-of-life care, our long-term care into high-quality care at home options. And our alliance, and I speak for myself and our team and our board, I hope all of you, I hope that you're on board with supporting our national partnership here. We are here to partner with this goal. So when we think about access to care at home, one of the most urgent issues, I'll just talk about one of the most urgent, right in front of us concerns for high quality, high integrity hospice care at home is the implementation, CMS implementation of the Hospice Special Focus Program, sometimes referred to as the SFP. I just want to point out that the Alliance has been at the forefront of trying to get CMS to implement this program as Congress intended and as we believe would create a safer and a higher quality hospice system, focusing on survey deficiencies and programs that are not meeting the requirements to be in hospice, Unfortunately, they've gone down this road of pulling in somewhat unstable and unreliable CAP scores and HCI scores and methodologies that are hard to follow and understand. They put some people on the list that we can't figure how they got to the top of the list and taken others off. And they move forward, naming, publicizing a quote unquote bottom 50 list at the end of December of hospice providers that are now being subject without any due process, without any appeals to the potential of losing their status. And, you know, of course, there's nothing more we want than to see low quality, dangerous programs continue, because it just brings us all down. But the arbitrary nature of this and the way that this was done, inconsistent with the law, is just it's terrible. And so every organization that I'm aware of that cares about hospice and the future of hospice in our country has pushed back. We are going to continue to look at every opportunity to fix that flawed program, be it legislative, working with the regulators and other types of advocacy. The other issue, and again, there are many here, other issue kind of urgently before us, imminently before us, is seeing that 3-month extension of telehealth flexibilities for face-to-face in hospice and in home health extended. We're optimistic that if there's an overall extension of those healthcare provisions that were brought forward at the end of the year for 3 months, that those will be extended, but we're staying vigilant and making sure they don't get dropped. And of course, it's hard to know anything for sure about what will happen with the broader healthcare extenders legislation, because Congress has very tight margins. The president has very aggressive priorities, and we will have to learn exactly how that plays out. But we're at the forefront of making sure that as that plays out, that those face-to-face flexibilities are maintained. And I will talk about one other topic here, the flawed and troubling implementation of the patient-driven groupings model. I talked about how our Medicare home health system has been basically disabled in many respects because of many billions of dollars being taken out of the system from a payment reform initiative that was supposed to be budget neutral, tens of millions of less visits, hundreds of thousands of less people being served, delays in care, a higher proportion of people needing to go to nursing homes after a hospitalization. This is not what Congress intended, and it's not good for our country. There have been numerous efforts over the last several years to try to turn the tide on this. I'd say the one thing that has worked a bit, nothing to be excited or satisfied about, has been pushing back on the pace of the permanent and temporary adjustments. Actually, right now with the Trump administration, what we are asking them is for a total pause on further adjustments. We need to make sure they know that they are not forced to go, you know, headstrong further with more permanent and temporary adjustments at a breakneck speed that's harming beneficiaries and destabilizing our care at home system. They have the time and manner discretion to hit the pause button, to take a timeout. We've seen them walk back some of the proposed cuts in recent years. And so they've used that discretion to provide less of a cut. We really want to see them now, given everything that's transpired, use their discretion to provide no cut and provide more time for some type of alternative regulatory or legislative solution to this problem that's been created by how CMS interpreted budget neutrality in the implementation of this law.
There's, Steve, a question about looking at initiatives to reduce administrative burden in home care service delivery in the ecosystem. What initiatives that you see that are there there's a number of things that we're working on as an industry, but if you want to hit a couple of those and what you've looked at.
It's just a constant focus for our team, our regulatory team. And, you know, not only are we trying to reduce look at the existing burden, but also try to reduce, onslaught of new ideas that could cause more trouble. For example, we're trying to advocate for occupational therapists to be able to open care at home and not have open home health episodes and not have that barrier. Of course, the telehealth flexibilities are important. We've just submitted comment letters around some OSHA regulations that are looking at heat injury in home community-based services that would be basically crippling to an agency, not even able to deploy staff on, it'd be unsafe for patients on a day where, the temperature went above 90 degrees. That topic is a constant. Patrick, are there some examples that you think are important for the audience to hear about that have been areas of focus of late?
Sure, and I'll speak broadly here. One point I will emphasize is your voice in this process. And what I mean by that, as we share comment letters to CMS, to the federal agencies and stakeholders, as we work through the impacts that these burdensome regulations can have upon our ability to provide care in the home, one voice that's loud above all others, over all others, is the actual voice of the provider in the home providing that care. Hearing stories of what this means for your clinical teams, what this means for your workflows, going to the home, conducting a visit, conducting an assessment, and how one change in regulation, one change in policy, such as looking at the OASIS or looking at other systems there, that can impact and add unnecessary processes and challenges as you work to staff and provide care and meet the needs of your communities. And one item that we're consistently focused on as the Alliance is how can we work with CMS, how can we work with stakeholders to ensure these minute but in critical details and echoing your voice in real time, what happens on the ground level, how that intersects with actual regulations and proposed policies, and ensuring we continuously address those on an ongoing basis. Right now, we're having conversations about the DEA telemedicine proposed rule, among many others, about how some of those policies can impact care delivery and what that will do to staffing and workflows, and then most importantly, how that will impact patients and their ability to timely receive the care and services they need.
Thanks, Patrick, and thanks for pointing out the DEA telemedicine issue as well, which we're very active on right now.
Another telehealth question. What do we believe of telehealth reimbursement for home health services? Do we think that's, obviously we have it where we can use it, but we don't have reimbursement today.
Yeah, I mean, I think the rulemaking has improved marginally. So, at one point, the Medicare policy documents were quite vague. Now it is clear, at least, that if virtual services or telecommunications, I think would be the term they would use, are part of a physician or provider ordered plan of care, then they may be used to improve the quality or efficiency of care, which is actually really good news because we didn't have that. I actually did a home visit with at one point, Hillary Loeffler, she came to our agency and she did a home visit related to telehealth, and they ended up changing their rules, changing the way they worded those rules. And so there is some accommodation there that everyone should be aware of, that you can use these technologies to improve the quality and efficiency of care if they're part of the care plan. But in terms of direct reimbursement, so that might count towards a visit in the episode or some other payment mechanism, there's not an imminent opportunity. And anybody that's really passionate or thinking about that, always send me a note. I'd love to talk more about what you're doing or how you're thinking about it, because we're at a moment here where we have to make sure that we capture back some of the value that's been taken out of the system through the PDGM implementation. And we've got to make sure we keep that front and center And at the same time, there are some of these other modernization opportunities that you know, we need to try to capture.
Right.
But I don't see an imminent solution for that. But it's definitely on the radar.
I mean, I agree with you. I know that you did that visit with Hillary Loeffler. I know when I met with her, I mean, she seems interested and has gone down the path, but the meetings I hadn't seen that either along the way. Do you think EVV will be required for hospice visits at some point? If is there anything that's being floated around related to that?
EVV and hospice topic, Patrick, if you could mention if that's come across your desk. I've not seen any recent polls along those lines, but I defer to Patrick's expertise.
It's not come to my desk there, Steve, although there have been some questions about this in the past. Overall, I would say there's not a strong appetite, at least just yet, in the hospice area, which is not to say it couldn't come on the horizon. With the administration's focus more focused on business and reducing some of the more problematic and burdensome regulations we've seen, I will acknowledge that I think where we've been effective is making the voice loud and clear, in a sense that I think there will be some Herculean challenges to overcome if and when there is a push to move this into the hospice space. Of course, we continue to have our ears close on the ground, and we'll continue to engage here as appropriate on behalf of our members in the industry.
So thanks, Patrick. I want to thank Steve and Patrick for joining. I will end by just saying a lot of the things that Steve said. We absolutely need all of you to be advocates for us. We can't just have industry leaders in DC working with it. It's really critical that we have the grassroots efforts. When you see the notices that come out from the Alliance about contacting and it's just clicking a button, I can't tell you how important it is that your local legislators see those. Even if you've done it multiple times, keep hitting those buttons, keep sending those emails to your senators, to your members of the House. When we get in there to meet with them, they notice that. And if we're not continually doing that, other industries are, we will not be as successful. So it's really important to support the Alliance for Care at Home and with Steve and Patrick and the entire team.
Thanks, Mike. It's been an honor,
Steve. Thanks, everyone, for your time today.
Thank you.
At NetSmart, we understand the challenges facing provider organizations. Our team will help you navigate changing value-based care models with solutions and services that make person-centered care a reality. We'll equip you with technology and services that provide holistic, real-time views of care histories that inform better decision-making and better outcomes. Visit us today at ntst.com. NetSmart, serving you so you can serve others. Thanks for listening to the NetSmart Care Threads podcast. Through collaboration and conversation, we can work together to make healthcare more connected than ever before and better support the communities we serve. To ensure you never miss an episode, please subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast player. If you use Apple Podcasts, we'd love for you to give us a quick rating for the show. Just tap the number of stars that you think the podcast deserves. Until next time.